From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Emily Rooney. This is Boston Public Radio. Well, at least they are talking, sort of. The White House rolled out its budget proposals as the deadline nears. But, of course, GOP lawmakers have dismissed it out of hand, calling it a joke. We're watching that. We're also watching what's happening with Elizabeth Warren. Talk is now Warren may be tapped for a Senate Banking Committee seat, but financial services types aren't too happy about that. Later this week, also, we could find out if Senator John Kerry is going to be a member of the new cabinet, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, or maybe just plain senator from Massachusetts. Well, we should know that by the end of this week. I'm joined here in the studio by Scott Lehigh, Boston Globe columnist, and Trey Greeson, director of the Institute of Politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Endless speculation. And then, of course, former Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel's name came up again over the last few days as a possible contender for one of the cabinet posts, but Secretary of State. But I don't know. I mean, does either of you think that the president is just hell-bent to name Susan Rice?
Not hell-bent, no. I think he's let her sort of hang out there and make her case. And I think the thing was all set up for one of those moves where you meet with the senators who object to you and they come away from it saying, well, we sat down with her. And
that wasn't so bad.
It didn't really work that well.
Yeah, I was surprised. I thought those meetings would solve the problem. And I don't know that it made it worse, but it certainly didn't make it better. He does seem pretty committed to her. I mean, you know, he defended her pretty robustly. But, he's got to make the decision. Does he want to force it? He'll win. If he nominates her, unless there's some skeleton that we don't know about, which presumably would have come up during the confirmation for ambassador, he should get the votes. I can't imagine he can't get 60 votes for her. But does he want to force that fight?
Does he need the distraction, too?
Yeah, the distraction with the fiscal cliff and everything
endless
else.
Endless discussion about this Benghazi thing. I mean, you know, not that I'm dismissing all the Republicans' concerns over it, because definitely there was a lot of confusion there. But I'm just – cynical as I am, I'm not cynical enough to believe that they intentionally skewed that information.
It's three-fourths trumped up, and that's a little bit of the problem here is they don't want to – give in, capitulate to, which is really a kind of a Fox News enterprise. I mean, there are some concerns there, but you remember this started. It was a cover up, and it was they were going to pretend Al Qaeda wasn't in the equation anymore. And as you watch this thing being dissected point by point, all of that's fallen away. And so I think there's an issue of should she have said more? Did she know more? Would her judgment have led her to believe something beyond the talking points? But the idea that she was sort of purposefully going in to mislead people on the talk shows, I think, is ridiculous. I was with Tom Ricks on the with him, but I mean, I liked what he said on Fox News, where he said, you guys manufactured a whole big stew out of nothing here, essentially. And the Fox News people kind of said, well, thank you very much.
We did that on Friday, Beat the Press. Yeah. Tom Ricks, a colorful, military correspondent, spoke very directly to this guy, John Scott, I think he was talking to. And he came on to talk about his new book, The Generals, and the interview did not go 25 seconds because he accused Fox News of trumping up the Benghazi story. John Scott says, well, thank you very much. I thought Fox News liked to fight. They just summarily dismissed the guy right off the show.
Fair, balanced, and truncated.
Yeah, exactly.
But speaking of hell-bent, I mean, John McCain seems kind of hell-bent on this. I was actually in D.C. at a post-election conference when he publicly reiterated – or I guess not reiterated. He was asked point blank, would you filibuster? He said, yeah. He was sitting with Lindsey Graham, and I don't know if Lindsey was ready to do that, but sitting next to McCain, he wasn't going to disagree.
He always looks like a pipe bomb getting ready to go off, doesn't he?
McCain.
He's got that kind of fake, calm demeanor.
That's the tragedy of John McCain in a way. He's really evolved into – he could have been a statesman post-election. Mm-hmm. And you occasionally will see an inclination of him to strike at what he knows is a better interest for the country post. But he seems to be so embittered that he and he is kind of a wrathful guy anyway that he has let himself slip into the role of a angry person.
Cantankerous.
It's really too bad.
He's a borderline crank.
Yes.
But you've also put, Lindsey Graham, Kelly Ayotte. I mean, these are not the most partisan of individuals who are leading this fight. So we'll have to see how it plays out. I think you're right. This is the key week.
I'm surprised by Kelly.
Me too. I was going to say, I'm surprised that Kelly has let herself get sucked into that matrix. Do you really want to be the mascot for the two kind of, the grumpy old man and his longtime pal, and you want, maybe you want to, you know, you're sort of going to that Susan Collins, Joe Lieberman role, I would think you would want to craft something a little bit different for yourself.
Yeah, right? I'm shocked that she got
And Collins is on this one, though, too. She's with them. Those four, those
Kelly
four.
Is brand new to the position.
Right. So yeah. Right. She's not even, this is a, like, you know, finishing her second year.
Yeah. In New Hampshire, let's not forget, it turned out to be a, quite a blue state this time around. I mean, you could make a case before, well, look, this is kind of a contrarian, you know, Warren Rudman sort of posture here that she struck. But this time around, I think it was 6 points, didn't it? And it really, you know, you got to.
You know, both members of Congress.
Yeah.
All right. So, Trey, Scott and I are a little close to this. Give us a little more distant perspective here. I mean, speaking for myself, not you, Scott, but it feels like John Kerry has certainly earned the right to get this position if he wants it. I mean, what's the take from people that haven't lived with John Kerry for the past 30 years?
No, I think that's, you know, he has been the good soldier, if you will. He has been the chair of this committee for several years and a ranking member for a long time. And, you know, he's a senator. It does seem like this is the time, if there's ever going to be a time for him. It's pretty clear that his colleagues would confirm him. You know, some of these same members who are objecting to Susan Rice are saying good things about him. Now, there may be some political calculations with that as well.
Because of the Senate race.
Because of the Senate race. But this does appear to be his time. Just in disclosure, he's on our senior advisory committee, although honestly I don't have a great relationship with him because usually our meetings have conflicted with Senate business. So I haven't had a lot of chance to work with him. But just in the interest of disclosure, mm-hmm. I thought I'd say that. But I don't have any particular insights. But he's the guy who would be a consensus candidate who you know, the Senate would confirm, world leaders know, and you know, he would be a you know, probably a pretty effective voice for the president going forward.
There's no small irony there, given how intractably opposed the GOP was to Kerry. And you remember a couple of years ago when Kerry misspoke about the joke on Iraq, mm-hmm. and what a manufactured sense of outrage we had about what was just really a simple verbal gaffe. But people were.
What was it again? I can't remember.
Oh, he meant to say of George Bush, look, if you aren't careful, you'll get us stuck in Iraq. If you don't study hard at college and you're not careful, you'll get us stuck in Iraq. Meaning the W had done that. Instead, he said, you'll get stuck in Iraq. And the Republicans immediately pretended they thought he was saying that people who weren't smart would go into the military and get stuck in Iraq. And they jumped on it and just portrayed him as some kind of a anti-American, anti-patriot. And I got to say, I find it a little amusing now that they're all praising him as the best choice to be the Secretary of State.
I mean, my guess is that if he was offered something else, like DOD or anything, he wouldn't take it.
I think you're right on that. He does not want DOD. And, you know, frankly, it's not completely altogether clear that I was at a function recently. I was talking to Mrs. Hines, and I don't think she is necessarily crazy about having him take the Secretary of State thing.
How was she doing, by the way? She's
she was up and around, and you hear different things on that. But she was, you know, she looked good on this particular night, I will say.
It is hard work to be the Secretary of State. I mean, somebody, I think it was Ed Rendell, was at the IOP, and he's like, you travel around like the president but without Air Force One.
Yeah, exactly.
And you always see it's tiring. They're always crisscrossing the country. And
the world.
Then the world. Yeah, excuse me, crisscrossing the world. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tremendous amount of work.
And he actually is in quite a good position right now in the Senate. You know, so I mean, it's not as though
job.
It's not a consolation prize to be chairman of foreign relations.
Clearly has a safe seat.
All right, what's going to happen with this tedious fiscal cliff? Over the week, I just couldn't listen to this Sunday talk shows. You'd think that I had this idea that they should have brought Mitt Romney in to solve this. You know, he would have had to be the great mediator, but it's like.
I think the good news is you're going to have plenty to talk about over the holiday break here on the show.
That it's not going to be resolved until December 31st.
I mean, the way they're going, all along I thought they'd resolve it. I just thought that both sides had too much at stake in trying to get off to the right, onto the right foot in this new term, even though this is still the lame duck of the old term, that, you know, that the president wanted to sort of solve this because it's a little bit easier to put something in place so they can then build a grand bargain so he can be on Mount Rushmore. The Republicans want to show that they can actually accomplish something. And so I thought they could do this.
Did you think the proposal by the White House was an insult? $1.6 trillion in tax revenue, Medicare cuts, $50 billion in stimulus money.
Was that a joke? It doesn't have as much entitlement reform as if you're going to raise that much in tax revenue for the Republicans to take at this point. It doesn't have enough as much entitlement reform as it needed. And so whether it's a joke or just a non-starter or whatever word you would use, I can see why it was rejected summarily.
But I mean, he does have, let's not forget, he's got the whip hand here in that when the Bush tax cuts expire, the tax cuts for the wealthy will expire, and there will be a huge amount of pressure to re-up for the middle class, and that will leave the Republicans with something they very much don't want, a situation where they either have to be holding the middle class breaks hostage, or they have to sort of abandon their base and say, okay, we're just going to do the breaks.
People forget everybody's taxes are going to go up. Taxes
will go up. Yeah, the president does have a little bit of an upper hand. Now, you know, the House Republicans could pass a bill extending everything, and it dies in the Senate, and if the economy tanks, you know, probably the president gets more of that blame. But it's a shame because they really – both of you guys read Bob Woodward's book detailing the struggles that the president –
I didn't.
You ought to read it.
It annoys me the way he writes that.
This is kind of a tedious book. Okay, yeah. So don't read it. But this one's rather tedious. But here's the point. The point is that there's no relationship between the president and Congress, frankly, on both sides, and he's not a great negotiator. And so fortunately, though, you get a chance for a reset here. He got reelected. He got essentially somewhat of a mandate. You can argue over how much of a mandate.
Yeah. Landslide is what it was.
Yeah, yeah. But the House Republicans kept control. Yeah, so yeah. That's why I'm saying it's not a total mandate. But they have to change the way they did business because they didn't do business together in the last term. In his first term, and they got to do a better job this time.
Boehner, I think, is an adult who would like to get this done.
You do?
I do, yes. I honestly believe that. McConnell,
why can't they sit down and work this out?
Well, see, he's got a problem here because they're locked into this, I think, largely specious notion that moving rates up is a top rate. Rather than generating more revenue, but getting more rates will be some kind of disaster. It's a part of supply-side theology. It's ahistorical. You don't see that through any of the data, but they're very locked into that notion. So he desperately does not want to do that. He's been willing to essentially cave on the revenue piece of it, but what he's got there to save himself to say, look, I held firm on this, is the idea you're not going to increase rates. And Obama, as I say, he's got the rates will expire if they don't go along. Now, okay. Obama's saying here, I think rightly, if you guys want to cut entitlements more,
but like
show
what?
Us what you want to do.
Exactly. What
put it on the table, guys, and let's talk about it.
That was my next What entitlement? I mean, what are they talking about?
Well, you're going to have to cut Medicare, Medicaid. You have to. I mean, in order to get the long-term problem addressed, you have to do that. And so the question is, how much of that in the short run do you need to do? Because what the whole goal with the fiscal cliff talks is to get this off the table. And so next year, in the middle of the summer, in the fall, they can actually come up with a big deal, the so-called grand bargain. And the grand bargain is going to have entitlement cuts. Because that's just the only way you get the long-term deficit under control. But for the Republicans, they're like, you're not going to be you can't expect us to raise taxes if you're not going to give a little on entitlements. That's the argument.
But when you say cut that stuff, what do you mean?
Well, that's an interesting question. What exactly do they mean? And you'll recall that all through the campaign, Mitt didn't talk about specifics. Ryan didn't talk about specifics. They talk about reducing domestic spending to a certain level of GDP. But they didn't really say beyond Amtrak subsidies and stuff that was just penny ante piddly diddly what they would actually cut. So what Obama is saying here is, okay, guys, put forward what you want to cut. And they're saying, no, Mr. President, you have to come up with something beyond the $600 billion of what you would cut. So it's a little bit of a...
Well, I think they did talk about a little bit more about on the entitlement side of you know, the premium support plan of Paul Ryan. But I will agree that in this conversation, they're not being very specific about what would it take to get this short-term
but
deal.
You remember
I think that's a fair point.
They retrofitted the premium support thing. So they went back and essentially said, look, we're going to bid out cost of current program, and we're going to do that every year. So we're not even talking – this gets a little technical. We're not even talking the inflator. So you're not going to – if you want to stay with traditional Medicare, you will have that or comparable services.
Right.
So they kind of backed away from Ryan's own plan in the closing month and a half of the campaign. So they don't really have – other than turning Medicaid over to the states – as a block grant and letting Medicaid decrease, not stay up with inflation, they don't really have a very good plan. And Medicaid, don't forget, that the biggest chunk of people who benefit from Medicaid are seniors in nursing homes. So that's not going to be awfully popular with a lot of middle class families.
It's a long run. I think the simplest phrase that I've always heard is bending the cost curve, that in the short run, you're not doing much. It's over the long run, you're having the rate of increase approach the rate of inflation as opposed to
there you try to do it through – I mean the Democrats will say that. They're trying to do it through medical – through cutting medical costs rather than reducing eligibility or reimbursements to recipients. Right. They would like to say, look, doctors, you can do fewer tests. You do more bundled payments, more accountable care, that kind of thing. Squeeze the saving out of the systems. But you recall in the campaign when Obamacare did that to the tune of half a trillion, and that became an issue that Romney and Ryan were attacking on. He cut Medicare. So it's a box for both sides. But I think what the president's saying here is to these guys, come on, you say we need to cut this stuff. Well, what is your plan?
Exactly.
Because he doesn't want to take all the heat for proposing the cuts, having just come off.
Which is why he put this plan out, was this to basically call their bluff.
All right, talking politics as usual with Boston Globe columnist Scott Lehigh and Trey Grayson, director of Harvard Kennedy School's Institute of Politics. More in a minute. We're going to turn to some local issues, including the impending jury trial of Tim Cahill. That's going to go to the jury tomorrow. We should have an answer on that very shortly. I'm Emily Rooney. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Emily Rooney, talking politics, as usual, with Trey Grayson, director of the Institute of Politics at Harvard's Kennedy School, and Scott Lehigh, Boston Globe columnist. How close have you been following the Tim Cahill trial, Scott?
I have not been in the courtroom, but I'm interested in it. Yeah. I'm watching it. I think Cahill did himself some good in his testimony.
Oh, you do?
But I do.
Because he got testy. He got a little annoyed. I would,
too. In his testimony. But I'm talking about day one when he's on the stand telling his side of the story. I think they sort of methodically took it apart, his story, on day two. Mm-hmm. I think this is a case where the laws changed and got tougher, and Tim Cahill didn't change. I don't buy his story. The question is, how plausible is it to the jury? If you look at the email trail, the communications with the campaign consultants, they pretty clearly were saying, let's hijack this lottery budget and use it in a way that reinforces Tim's Treasury campaign. Now, you've got to convince people that's – I think people in the state are very inclined to say, oh, so what? That's just the way it goes. Mm-hmm. Don't they all do that? Is this really
a
crime? And the fact that he could go to jail for 5 years for it, I think will give people pause about convicting. But – I think that nonetheless, I think he did do what he is charged with doing. I would not want to see him go to jail.
There's no question about that.
Yeah. A couple months maybe, but I wouldn't want to see him go to jail.
Oh, my God. I wouldn't want to see him to go to jail at all.
But I don't think you should be able to do this kind of thing. And that is $1.8 million they used for political purposes.
I thought it was 1.6. Oh, well.
1.6. Okay. Right.
Still a lot of money. Yeah. I mean, as a former elected official, this is one of my biggest frustrations. And we had a pot of money that I could have used for voter education when I was Secretary of State of Kentucky. And I didn't do those kinds of commercials. I just didn't think it was right.
But our guy used to do them. Bill Galvin did them for years.
Bill Galvin, although Galvin will tell you he's done them off cycle.
He doesn't do them
on an election year. He does them previous year.
I swear he did them.
We had the unclaimed money list. And, they have
it's
done
it's
this
fine line
things.
Because it's your job, right? And so, you're elected. The public knows there's potential conflicts. I mean, there's other things that I'm sure that people would say, well, you went to this event officially, and it obviously helped you out politically. But that I just thought the TV ads were, do a TV ad that's effective without the office holder in it.
He's claiming that he knew his candidacy was doomed and he was just trying to resurrect and preserve the reputation of the lottery, and that he was fighting back on this Republican Governors Association ads, which had really just been viciously attacking him. And he thought, I'm not going to leave without, putting back into place the reputation of the lottery.
Well, that's
not believable.
To believe him, there's a nobility and a selflessness about him that would bring tears to your eyes. But if you consider that they had a campaign meeting the night before and talked about the way lottery ads with focus groups talked about the way it would enforce his message, and you look at the emails that the campaign consultants were writing back and forth about getting him to agree to use the lottery money, it tells really quite a different story.
I'm also amazed. How long have we had email? Like, why?
Oh,
let's assume that like they actually made this plan to use money, you know, just for sake of discussion. Like, why are you writing it down in an email? I know it's more convenient. Pick up the phone, have the conversation. Yeah. I just like the stupidity sometimes of these of elected officials and government officials who get caught with their hands in the cookie jar. It's like, why?
Yeah, because you never want to commingle election staffs with office staff.
Right.
Never mind this.
Yeah.
This is a whole reach across.
Yeah.
You know,
it's just like
span.
That's why you just have to put that Chinese wall up and just keep them divided.
All right. Subject I'm endlessly fascinated with, the health of Boston Mayor Thomas Menino. Last Thursday it was the mayor's office granted an exclusive interview to Channel 5's Susan Warnick and then allowed Andrew Ryan from the Boston Globe and Dave Wedge from the Boston Herald in for about a 20-minute interview. What was your take on that, Scott?
Well, I watched some of the tape of it, and I got to say he looked exhausted and sedated. And, I mean, he's – you never mistake him for Cicero necessarily, but I thought he just – I mean, he looked like he was
Terrible.
Yeah, I mean, really, I don't believe if I were the mayor's people I would have done that. I think it kind of hurt him. A lot of
Dave
people
Wedge said he was nodding off at times and kind of like, you know.
Yeah.
He wasn't ready for that.
No,
I mean, I
understand
why they wanted to do the Christmas tree greeting. And I don't know why they couldn't have just done that and nothing else. But I guess they felt if you got a reporter in there, you know, you got to go another inch.
Well, they must have thought that he would look better and it would come off somewhat more crisply than it did. But it I mean, honestly, let's just be brutally blunt. It looked like a guy whose health is not good and who – you know, probably should not be running for another term.
For the event.
As opposed to being on the road to recovery, which is what you'd want to show in that kind of image. Yeah.
I mean, which leads to the, you know, endless issue about who is really running the city, because it didn't appear to me, and again, I'm not a medical professional, that a man in that condition could be making sharp, focused decisions about how to, because I'm sure you get in too. We're getting all these press releases. Mayor Menino announced today, and Mayor Menino do this. It's like, it's just no way.
I don't know. It's a very good question. Who is really running the city? I mean, maybe it's Dot. Maybe it's Michael Knievy. I mean, one of the things that amused me, the mayor said, was he said, "Well, this is not like the old days when someone said, 'I'm the mayor, just do it because I said so.'" Well, the old days of Mayor Menino, that's what he used to do. I mean, that was kind of his MO. And he's trying to say now, look, I've got a whole great array of cabinet people that can function on their own. Well, maybe. I mean, I still think the city has been more or less run out of city hall for most of.
Well, what should he do?
Measures.
Should he just say, "I'm going to step aside for a few weeks while I focus on my," what would you do if you were in that position?
I don't think people begrudge him time to recover his health
for
this
all.
Term. I think they should be much more transparent about how the actual decisions are being made. And as I wrote, what he really should do is say, "Look, I've had five terms. That's quite enough. It's been a great honor to be your mayor," and let people know early enough that other candidates can sort of plan their campaigns.
Yeah.
He's not the
He's
indispensable
not
man. I actually kind of think he will. I think your physicality has a way of – your physical reality has a way of sort of imposing on you a sense of what you need to do.
And I think there's so many people around him who encourage him to essentially be mayor for life.
Yeah. I'm a newcomer. He doesn't have an heir apparent, right? So if he can't run, it becomes a free for all. Is that essentially the
essentially,
common wisdom?
Yeah. Well, you know, unfortunately, in this city, what happens far too often is the only springboard that seems very plausible to people is the city council, which is a weak, underpowered, and not very impressive body. We need to have a situation where you would see businessmen or Paul Grogan
at
the Boston Foundation get in, people that are maybe bigger figures. Now there are a couple city councilors who would be plausible candidates and good candidates, but there is not someone. I mean, there was. You could argue, 15 years ago there might have been someone waiting in the wings, but Mayor Menino has been there so long, having said he was only going to serve two terms initially. He's now served five, and most of his rivals have gone on to do other things and said, "Look, I just can't outwait the guy, and I don't want to take him on." Now, I personally think this time is different. I think if he does run for re-election, let's say he's in the midst of a campaign and something happens, and we've seen recurrent extended hospital stays in the last few years. Let's say he went back into the hospital in the midst of a heated governor or a mayoral campaign. I think that would be.
I think he'd be reelected.
No,
what happened
I
with Jesse Jackson Jr.?
People aren't sentimental. I don't think they're sentimental
really?
When they think.
I think they are.
It's about us, not about you.
Hmm. You're not weighing in on this one. You don't really.
I don't know as much. Yeah. I don't know enough to weigh in.
Yeah, and that's all right. We do. I don't know.
I've been enjoying listening and learning.
Yeah, I really believe that the people around him, you know, have convinced. I think Angela would like to see him continue.
I don't know. I kind of feel the other way on that. That she would like to. She probably realizes that he's had a great run, and I don't know. I don't have inside information there, but I think there will be a division here between people who rely on him for their own continued employment at City Hall and the people who are really looking out for his best interest.
That's the one thing I can't weigh on that. That's the one thing you have to watch is the divided loyalty there.
Mm. Well, I mean, the mayor's race is in 2013. If he is still in the hospital or in an incapacitated state come January 1st, I think you could be right.
Well, the other thing about Mayor Menino, let's not forget, his whole secret has been this. He's out everywhere. Yeah. He's all around the city. You see him. He's got this endless appetite to be out there on meetings 5 or 6 nights a week, and he'll do that. And I don't think you're going to find a guy coming out of the hospital who will have the energy and the physical presence. And people will notice that when it drops off. It's a sad thing. I mean, it's never comfortable to say to someone, look, you know, you probably – given your state of health and your age, it's time to call it quits. But I do think that's where we are here.
Talking to Scott Lehigh from the Boston Globe and Trey Grayson from the Institute of Politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. All right, so already Elizabeth Warren, you know, she hasn't even taken the seat yet, and there's pushback should she get something on the Senate Banking Committee. I mean, come on. She's perfect for the job. That's her specialty. I guess the people, bankers, are afraid she's going to overregulate them take their money back.
It strikes you as kind of a no-brainer. I mean, the one thing I guess one question is, of the Democrats who aren't returning to the Senate, are their seats are open? How many seats are out there? Because you have a little bit of that issue. This is a committee that usually has a lot of demand because you can raise money from financial types, and because people have an interest in it, like
yes,
her.
Yeah.
So you have there's that part of it, but I haven't heard that that's an issue here. I think it's, you know, a pushback because she would, as a freshman, would get on there on day one and know as much or that more than most of the members already on the committee.
And that scares them.
Yeah.
I would think there'd be large pressure for this. So she's a national star. She's probably the biggest person elected this cycle, best known nationally.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And I would think there would be real opposition. But she's an expert in a lot of areas that have to do with the banking committee.
That's the part I don't understand.
Very tender feelings.
Why do you
financial
oppose
industry.
Somebody who knows that much? That's the whole idea. Isn't this about the American public, not about your hurt feelings?
Well, I think for the financial industry, you look at – I mean, Obama came in and at least in my view, largely bailed them out from some big blunders they'd made. And they, rather than appreciating that, they seem to be very injured and bruised that he was portraying them as some people who could pay a little more and who'd done well. And we had the whole class warfare trope, which I think is ridiculous. But yeah, I think part of this crowd thinks that they really are, as Tom Wolfe said, the masters of the universe. And they think that their feelings and prerogative maybe count for something more than they should.
Yeah. Well, by the way, does this happen right away? You know how Congress works better than I do.
She would go on at the beginning. You know, she'd get sworn in right after the first of the year, and the committees would start meeting in January. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, with the presidential election.
And no, but who gets to decide? Does it go to the full body for?
I think it's leadership that decides.
Democratic caucus.
Yeah,
with a vote. There's usually a vote that you have to reaffirm. It's a little different procedures depending on whether you're Republican or Democrat.
Yeah, there is a seniority factor, and there's that part of it. But as far as the freshmen that are coming in, you would assume there's at least one open seat, and you can't.
Yes,
I can't.
Yeah.
And the other thing that could be going on here is it could be that this is just a done deal, and so they're letting these stories float to make it look like, oh, she was opposed, and when she gets on there, she's even more powerful.
That's a good thought. Yeah, that very well could. I don't know if you saw on the House side, there's only going to be one. There's going to be one woman chairman in the United States House of Representatives. I saw in the paper the other day. I find
that
is shocking. Astounding.
How many women congressmen are there now?
Oh,
20% now, I think.
Yeah,
I mean, a lot of them are Democrats, and you have the Republicans controlling. There is one woman in Republican leadership, Kathy McMorris Rogers from Washington State, who won a contested leadership fight and actually overcame the opposition of Paul Ryan, who endorsed at the last minute her opponent. But yeah, and I think Scott's right, and it was a last minute thing, and it's House Admin, which is not the most powerful committee.
Now, has she totally disappeared from Harvard yet? Do you know?
Well, she was on leave, so I think she's probably
She really has been sort of low profile
yeah.
since.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Other than
a couple of columnists by your colleague
yeah,
Brian
yeah,
McGorry, who's coming on
dog.
Shortly,
yeah.
the story about the yeah. dog. I actually was at her house. It was the Thursday before the storm, so whatever that day of the week that
yes.
was. So it was like, you know, October 25th or something like that. And the dog was there, and they were mixing up this stew of sort of medicines for him. They were putting it in hand-ground hamburger, and Otis was, you know, you could see he was big. He was a huge dog. That dog probably weighed 150 pounds.
Wow.
And, you know, and he was just lying on the floor. It was sad. It was like you could tell he wasn't doing that well. But I didn't know he died.
I will say that as a professor, she was very well regarded by I talked to some of my Republican conservative friends who had her as a professor, and they loved her as a professor. So her loss, she will be a real loss as a teaching faculty member to the university.
So if John Kerry gets this post, Scott, is Scott Brown going to get back in?
Well, you know, I have to say, yeah, I think he would. And you take away the structural problem, he could say, look, you vote for me, it's not going to mean Republican control of the Senate. We know that. It would just change it one vote. I think you'd be a strong candidate.
And turnout would be lower. You know,
yeah.
Turnout with the,
yeah.
I think his turnout in the special was in the high 50s, which is great by a special election, but not compared to 75 or whatever
yeah.
it was statewide. So he'd have a better shot at winning based upon the folks who
even
won't
though- They were saying, you know, the giant was sleeping, John Walsh
well,
and all those guys
know,
during the special
the
election.
Problem, I mean, who's the candidate? You look on the Democratic yeah. side and you say, are we back to – are we talking about yeah. Eddie Markey? We've been talking – nice guy, but
Michael
we've been talking
Capuano.
About him running for the Senate since 1984.
84, I know.
Mike Capuano, I don't think he did himself any favors. You know, he just – he doesn't seem – to my mind, does not seem senatorial. The governor doesn't seem to be very interested. Tim Murray would be a joke. So who really – unless you're going to pluck someone out of the you know, out of the blue that we don't know about, I don't see the person out there. Now, and I'm someone who thinks Scott Brown ran an atrocious campaign and you know, completely short-sighted. And if his campaign team had half a brain, they could have won that race. But or they could have done much better in the race anyway. But I got to say, I do not see a Democrat on the horizon who I think is a formidable figure at all.
Yeah, I can't think of anybody either. Alrighty, that is going to do it for us this afternoon. Politics, as usual. I've been joined by Boston Globe columnist Scott Lehi and Trey Grayson, director of the Institute of Politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thanks. It's been fun.
Thanks.
Always.
Good time.
And Edgar B. Herwick III is back in the studio.
Hey, Emily. How you doing?
Good.
So breaking
got
news on the sports front, we got a Red Sox signing
oh,
happening
boy.
Right now. So according to league sources, the Red Sox have agreed on a deal with Mike Napoli to play first base and catcher.
Yeah, and what were they paying him?
A lot. More than you and I combined, I'm sure.
Oh, really?
They're going to pay him $39 million over 3 years
ridiculous.
Is being reported. So.
He wouldn't have done it for less. Huh?
Serious
All
money.
Right.
We'll see.
Okay, that's going to do it for me. I'm Emily Rooney.
I'm Edgar Herwick. We got a sports roundup coming up next on Boston Public Radio. Man, we're in the lane.